What's up? It's Kareem, aka Keys, longer name Keys to the Game. That's Keys with a Z on Instagram. For those who don't know who I am, I run a platform online to help independent musicians learn more about the music business. I do this by way of tips on a regular, videos, reels, and a host of other things that you can check out on my profile and as well as in the link in my bio. I just want to say thank you to everyone taking the time to listen to this. And if you're a first time listener, I want to welcome you and say thank you as well. Now, today's topic is about general struggles, beat licensing, and a little bit about engineer appreciation. I have received a lot of comments and questions and concerns from you guys about this topic, and I bumped into a woman on the application Clubhouse. She goes by the name of Ina Savaz. Ina is very, very well versed in the business. She's been around for some time. She has a pretty amazing story, and I decided to have her come on the show so that she could give you some more insight. And if you listen to any other previous episodes, you know that I'm only going to bring people on here who can really add value to your situation. So I connected with her. She said she'd do it. And I got a really, really good story that I'd like to share with you guys. But of course, before I dive into all of that, I just have a few announcements. I got a lot of things that are changing right now, and I want to let you guys know because there's some really cool things here that are going to help you out. As per usual, I still have my free 15-minute coaching call. It's a quick strategy call where you and I get on and we just talk about, you know, a few things that you're going through. And then from there, you know, we figure out a more precise way to help you out going forward. I do have a free video training inside of the link in my bio. The training will teach you a foolproof way to release your music, because I know that that's a very tough thing to figure out. You want to make sure you do your best when it comes to introducing new music to the public. So the training should be very, very helpful for you. I highly suggest you go and check that out. And then every Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, I do a live music review on Instagram. Ever since I've done it, guys and ladies, it's been a huge success. We've had lots of people tune into the live, give their feedback, submit their songs. A lot of networking going on inside of the chat at the time. Just a lot of magic happens on Wednesdays at 5:30, and I absolutely love it. So I highly suggest that you go and submit your music. If you're an artist, if you're a manager, submit your artist music using the link in my bio. You can send your tracks. Please, no WAV files, MP3s, or direct links only. So that wraps up my announcements. I guess I won't flap my gums too much. This is a bit of a beefier episode, but I promise you guys, it is worth every bit of investment. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and let Ina give her story and then dive into all the other meats and potatoes. I hope you guys enjoy. So let's dive right into it. Of course, you know, I want to give the people a bit of a backstory here. Like, you know, how did you even come about to be in the position that you're in right now? Like, you know, where did things start and leading up to, starting from then leading up to now? Tell me about that.
Okay, cool. So I'm from New York and DC. Kind of grew up in both. I came to Atlanta at 16. What brought me here was my father retired NYPD, and when he moved here to Atlanta, he became a partner and merged into a family business that was already growing and budding. My aunt has started HT Media, which was a CD duplication company, and they introduced album artwork to the South. So when we moved here, they were still writing on their CDs with Sharpie markers. Literally, I'm not being funny. I still have some of them. And so she came down here with the CD duplication machine, the burn CD machine, to speak. For layman's terms, I don't know the right term, sorry. But, you know, the machines that burn the CDs, put the music on it, and then she's a graphic designer doing the artwork. And so she came here, and they pretty much were pretty successful in the Southeast region. They were in about 18 different states, but they were based in Atlanta. So they did Jock's first album. They did Lloyd's, his album was Southside. I think it's called Southside, like Southside. Or Southside, yeah. Record on yeah, it. Southside, mm-hmm, that yeah. album. And so that's what started me in the music business as far as when we moved down here, it was to help her launch that. I mean, we're talking about sitting in a townhouse in Lithonia, my aunt, my grandmother, me, my father, my cousins, all boxing up these CDs that were being printed out, thousands of them, to quickly get them back out to the DJs, who are our biggest clients, and even to some artists and even to some corporations. This is when CDs were still a thing. And then from there, I kind of was just around, so to speak. That's and it was like, yeah, I was just around. We had a storefront over on Flat Shows right after you pass Southwest Acad Mall, the plaza that has the Sonics in it. So we were next to the Sonics in that plaza. So anyway, I was kind of just around, and I worked the front desk a little bit, but you know, I would see the artists pass through, the DJs pass through, like DJ Cutthroat, DJ Nola, Coalition DJs, DJ Holiday, all that good stuff. They would pass through there, and they kind of would, you know, my aunt had the relationships with them, but I wasn't musically focused then. I was kind of just hyped to be in Atlanta. I was 16 at the time, getting ready to turn 17. I was currently getting my GED because I would have had to be back 2 grades. School-wise, if I went to Southwest DeKalb High School, which is where I was supposed to go. So I got my GED from DeKalb Technical College. I got it at 17. Because I was considered a minor, I couldn't just take the test. I had to do a certain amount of hours in a program. And then from there, I went straight into Atlanta Metropolitan College. 17 turned 18 by 2008 and was doing my core. So anyway, fast forward a little more, during this time, I was in a group called the 90s Babies.
Okay. That's
yeah, it was pretty much just like me and my friends at the time. And I was like the female rapper in the group. And we would go to the studio and stuff like that. But it was like, we liked it and enjoyed it, but we really just thought it was a part of hanging out. Like, we wasn't.
Oh, I know about that. Yeah.
You know, it was just a thing. Now, yeah, it was just a thing. And we liked it, but it was people, we got presented with a contract. It was someone trying to take us seriously more than we were taking ourselves. My parents was like, you're absolutely not signing that contract. I didn't question it because I didn't really get it. So I was just like, all right, I mean, that's fine. I'm still going to hang out and record or whatever, but I guess we won't take it further. I was really oblivious. So that was like the first taste of the tone aside.
Not to cut you off, but sorry to cut you off, but it's more like, you know, there was no business. It was just really just none of the business stuff was happening at this point. It was just, you were just doing because it felt like that was, you know, like you said, it was just the thing, right?
Pretty much.
Okay, yeah.
Pretty much in a nutshell. So from there, like I said, we were living in Lithonia at first. We came down to my aunt's townhouse. Then we moved to Decatur, right? Not far from Golden Glide. And we was over by Wesley Chapel. And so this was during that era. Now, about a year or two out, I was around 18 at that time. We moved to Buckhead. And I was staying across from Justin's on Peachtree, next door to Benihana's. And this is when CDs began to die out. You know, my dad transitioned from HT Media, sold it or dissolved it, and then opened up a unisex salon. Right down Bennett Street where 1145 is. On that block is GB International. Him and his best friend was like an uncle to me. So anyway, this is when PR kind of began. I was around. I always loved hair. I went to Aveda for a second. That was my first love. That and singing were my two first love, but hair was, I was a little more doing it than singing. So anyway, I was around in a shop and my dad was like, I'm not paying a marketing person. I have a young person. She's going to do it. So I didn't have a choice. I was on foot, passing out flyers.
Oh, grassroots.
I was not driving.
Yeah.
Right. I didn't have a car. So I used to be on the bus, on the MARTA bus and the train, giving out flyers, and I used to literally be like escorting people down to my dad's shop. I would like, they would get off the bus at the same stop as me, and I would be like, oh my God, my dad has this really bomb shop. If you just let me show you for a second, I promise you would like it. Just come with me really quick. It's down the block. And I don't know why these people would come with me, but they would. I would talk them into walking with me to my dad's shop to show it to them. And I would be marching through there with them, and it was somebody different every single day. It was typically older than me. And it was women downstairs doing hair and men cutting hair upstairs. And I would bring them clients, and they would wind up being loyal clients to keep coming. And so people started noticing that. They would be like, they started telling me, like, do you do PR? You should do PR. You know what PR is? And I was like, girl, I don't know about PR. I'm just being myself. Like, I'm friendly. I could be a little extra, a little flavorful, a little spicy. I'm animated. That's really just how I am. So I really was just being me. I didn't even know PR was a thing. I wasn't thinking about that. I didn't think what I was doing was marketing. I thought I was like repping for just my dad's shop.
Pretty much.
Yeah, so that's how it got introduced to me. And then I was like, oh, so I could make money being me. Like, that's how I took it. I didn't take it deeper than that at first. I was like, oh, I could make money off of like me just doing what I'm doing, which is me. All right. So I started looking into it. And then I found out what public relations is and all that good stuff. And the founding of it, I'm very thorough in the research and a nerd. So I just took a deep dive in Google and found out what it was all about. And I was like, okay, you know, I kind of like the idea of it. And then it was like, people just started asking my dad, can your daughter come to my business and do the same thing? Can she come say this for me? I'm having this event and I need to say something. Can she write up a speech for me? People just started coming to me for PR stuff with me not even deciding I was going to do it. And it was like overwhelming. It was like every time I turned around, I was getting attention for PR or somebody was asking me to do it or offering to pay me to do it. So after a while, I was like, okay, like, come on. You need to tap into this or else what are you doing? So I started off with small businesses. And so my dad's a boutique. I worked with a women's boutique, a men's boutique, and a unisex one, a coffee shop, another hair salon. So Atlanta being Atlanta has Black musicians Hollywood. All over the place.
Black Hollywood.
Exactly. I wasn't checking for them, though. I wasn't on that. And I've never been the type to want a picture if I've seen them or autograph, or I've never kind of had that like groupie energy, so to speak. So I appreciated it being around. It definitely was inspiring, but I wasn't necessarily trying to work with them. So, or trying to be in it. And then I also was a little afraid of the industry, honestly, because of all the horror stories I heard. I was like, I don't know. You know, I'm kind of small businesses. You know, the worst thing is going to be is they can't afford stuff because they spent all their money to keep the lights on. But I don't know about all that other stuff. So I kind of was okay with the small business owners. And I was getting perks, you know, like free clothes from boutiques, getting my hair done for free. Like I was getting all these discounted things and perks on the products that the small business owners offered. So I was cool. But anyway, so their clientele was entertainers, though. And so eventually my first one, well, big one in my mind, started with Jamie Maureen. He was an actor on VH1's Single Ladies, and he had their other acting roles as well. But at that time, this is when Single Ladies on VH1, but Lisa Ray, Stacey Dash, and the other young lady was popping and was fresh and brand new. And he had a feature on there. And so he came to me, I think from the men's boutique or my dad's shop. No, I'm sorry. He was at a studio. It was a music studio under my dad's shop, and he was in there. And I came around the back and said what's up to the owner, and he introduced me and told Jamie that I did PR. And he was on set, and then from there, he asked me to be his PR agent. So he was my first real client, and I, like, he had braids in his hair and everything. He let me transform his image. I talked him into cutting everything off and just going with waves and everything, and cleaned him up and styled his first photo shoot to get his EPK together. Started taking him to red carpet events and things like that. So he was my first entertainer, so to speak, actor. Really, I didn't get to music yet. So during that time, the music studio under me was 872. It was with Terrell Bing. He unfortunately got killed recently, a few years ago. But he showed me how to write my first contract. He was the first music executive big person. He worked with 112 different people. He was a writer. He was the first person in music who told me, you know, like, he liked my mind. And every time he came to get a haircut at my dad's shop, he would just give me gems. Like, I was always inquisitive. So I would, like, be like, what are you doing? What's going on, Terrell? What's going on in the studio? And he would tell me. And then he would just give me gems and let me pick his brain. And he would, you know, like, tell me, like, you know, like, you're the 3%. You're smart. Don't let them tell you otherwise. He helped me with my first PR contract to seal things with Jamie. I went back to him and I was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to charge him. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And he introduced me to what a retainer was. And just like, you know, like how to structure out things on paper.
Wow. So he was very resourceful.
Very willingly. You know, again, this goes back to, but for free, he never charged me and he never made me intern. He never made me or even suggested I do anything for him. He literally would talk about the value I would bring when I was down the line years later and I would be next to him. So that's more so how he talked about it. Like, he felt like he was tending soil to like a future oak tree, I guess. And I guess he was like, I'm going to be able to pluck so much fruit from this. If I just help you plant it right, this will, you know, live for hundreds of years and it'll produce a lot of fruit and go through, it'll have a big, big harvest. I think that's how he looked at me or my mind or potential. And I mean this modestly, but he definitely, he was like a gardener for my soil and he did it willingly and he enjoyed it. He thought it was funny. It was interesting. And so, I thought that was really cool. I cherished that. I didn't understand why I was getting that. I didn't think I deserved the knowledge he was giving me. Yeah. But he will always tell me I did, but I always felt like, I know this knowledge is worth some money.
Yeah, he's giving me $1 million worth of game.
Yeah, and why are you giving it to me for free? But then he would expose his motives. It wasn't a secret. He would be like, yo, you'll be sitting next to me at a board table one day and we'll just be able to look at each other and close the deal.
Simple.
And I thought that was cool. And I felt like I understood that. And I was like, okay, so down the line, he wants an ally and he wants a young one to keep a foot in. Got it. I was cool with that. I didn't mind it. So anyway, after Terrell, introduced me to songwriting. He would have songwriting retreats there. And he was the one that was the first introduction to the business side of music and told me that I reminded him of a music executive. And so he kind of, I think he's the reason why I focused on the business first, because he was like, the talent side is cool, but you're an executive. Like, you sound like one, you think like one, like you have what it takes. So from there,
I feel him on that one. I get those vibes.
I appreciate that. And that was such a huge compliment to me. But at the time, I wasn't, they were big shoes to fill in my mind. Like, I didn't know how to walk that out. And I was intimidated about walking it out. I was like, I'm too young. But what are you talking about? I'm like 19, 20. Like, I just.
Imposter syndrome.
For sure. Definitely had that. And then I was fighting trauma. So I just wasn't even confident enough to really take the leaps and bounds to even walk out this path he was talking about. But I felt like eventually I may get there. So that's why I still wanted the knowledge and I cherished it. I definitely didn't brush it off, but I was just kind of like, this will clearly be under my cap for a few years. Like, I knew that. And I was cool with that. So from there, I still didn't go straight into music because the influx of business wasn't there yet. And I didn't even have like the clout or power yet to even attract musicians for real. But it was like, it was, you know, they was around, but it was more so, who is this chick, you know, watching me? And kind of like, we were associates as opposed to like, I'm gonna hire her. So from there, I'm getting into PR with Jamie. I'm running around Atlanta. taking him to red carpet events. Okay, so now let me, I don't want to skip it and make it seem like I just had access. No.
No, I think, you know, a lot of people should understand that, like, there is a struggle associated with getting to where all the glory and stuff is. So, no, it's fine if you take it there.
Bro, like, okay, so I was all over the place with the internships. Let me just say that, because I knew that labor and time was currency. So I started to treat it like that. So I willingly went into situations willing to trade that off. So I just started being upfront and aggressive and direct about it. I stopped waiting for them to ask, and I started being like, I'll do this if you do me that. Like, I just started, like, bartering. This is the barter queen. I went through a moment of bartering and no money. So Jamie gave me access to film set. So it was kind of like I got a different level of access from working with him, because when I submitted to go to red carpet events and I was able to put VH1 next to his name, it would get me in. Yeah. However, it was my first red carpet event. I was on the MARTA train. I was on a bus. I walked in my sneakers. I had heels in my book bag. I had only like $5 in my pocket, $2.50 on a MARTA card. And I hid my book bag in the bushes outside the building of the event, because I had to change it to my heels and I didn't want anybody to know that I walked there. I know it sounds like a movie, but this is really
listen, it's cool. I appreciate you being transparent about that.
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of me trying to orchestrate the perception I needed to get more access as a PR. However, not really being fake, but just kind of like not also, I couldn't be too transparent. I learned that early. Being transparent, nobody would work with me.
Yeah, in the business, that ain't going to work, because everybody,
I couldn't do it.
How can we count on you? You know what I'm saying?
Period. I couldn't do it. So that's how it was my first couple events. Or it was like, sometimes my clients was picking me up, or sometimes I was getting a cab there. I mean, it was so many times where I winged it to get there, and then we get in the building and, like, you know, turn into Olivia Pope, so to speak, but not like in a political manner or in a seductive manner. But as far as, like, I would research everybody who's going to be at the event, and I would, like, talk to my client and be like, okay, so, you know, this is what we're here for. These are the top three point of contacts in the room that we need to make sure we talk to. After we talk to them, we can go. And this is the last thing that they accomplished. This is the last show they were on. This is the last single they put out. This is the new company that they just started. Like, I would literally have given him this whole plan. Now, mind you, this was me. This is what I would do to navigate the room so that I wouldn't look like such a rookie. I would research people before I went there, so when I talked to them, it could feel more familiar than it was.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So no one taught me how to do that. It was just my way of trying to seem aligned. Yeah, I was trying to seem more aligned than I was. Right. So, like, for you, if I met you at an event, or if I knew you was going to be at an event, I wanted him to be on your podcast, I would have told him, like, okay, look, the people from Less Music Podcast are going to be there. It's been around for X amount of years. Listen to the last episode. When you talk to them, bring up the part in the last episode that you liked.
Yeah. Stuff that's going to really help win somebody over once you had that conversation.
Right. I mean, I had to. Yeah. What did I have to offer? Well, I didn't have a dime. I walked to get there. I was a nobody. So I had to be charming. That was getting me further than I'm this big shot. I wasn't a big shot. So it was kind of like, that's the way I had to maneuver, and Jamie maneuvered with me. I mean, we had to go thrifting to get new outfits sometimes before we went in there to have something impressive on. So fast forward from there, Jamie was my lab rat, kind of. He knew that to some degree as well. And, you know, he's not dumb. He let me practice on him, but he appreciated my honesty. And I didn't charge him. So I was free and honest, which was great. Pretty much. So from there, I had some Love and Hip Hop related opportunities. Back then, I the reality TV world started coming to me pretty much. And so I wasn't thrilled about working with the reality TV world because things could just get murky quickly or unexpectedly. It was really a risk reputation-wise because once you touch one of them, you're there. And like, it's hard to move to corporate or commercial success once you open it. They're on an island and they just work that whole circuit. And I didn't want to be gridlocked over there. So I did a lot more, I guess, prospecting over there as opposed to really securing things with them. A lot of one and done situations, pro bono, just kind of like a resume builder thing, a little bit locally, more so than like, we're going to go to distance. Then I stumbled upon Freddie O, the blogger and photographer, and I interned for him. And I helped him open up his store on Bennett Street. I was uploading to his site at a point, but most of the time I was with him running around the city of Atlanta. And
so at any point in time, like during all of this, like, were you songwriting? Like, were you doing any work on your own? No. So you still, at this point, you still haven't even got to the point where like, you're like, I want to be the one writing.
Nope.
What led you there? Like, why did you
end up? So what got me to songwriting? Okay. So after the whole PR run, cause that lasted for a while. That was probably from like 20 to 25. Mm-hmm. I want to say 19 to 25. That was for a good minute because I had decided in my mind and family members that I had missed the boat to be a star because I wanted to do it young. I had missed the boat to be on the talent side in my mind. So I was like, that ship has sailed. I'll live vicariously through the artists I work with and I'll find joy in that and I'll treat their campaigns like they're my own. I think that's why I was good at it because each one, it was personal. I was trying to be the PR I wanted. So that was that. And I didn't want them to feel like it was a conflict of interest. So I didn't show any signs of wanting to be on the talent side. I totally put that to bed because I didn't want them to think I would turn around and be their competition or try to be in the limelight. So I didn't get in pictures. I didn't make any of it about me. I put my client all the way before me and that dream just was kind of gone. So anyway, I get burnt out really bad. I mean, I get dehydrated. I get hospitalized for being dehydrated twice. And I'm having panic attacks and I just really got to my limit with PR. I mean, I was at this point when the burnout happened, I was managing about 20, 30 different social media accounts via Hootsuite and TweetDeck for various DJs by myself. My team was...
I have a hard time managing 3 accounts in Hootsuite. I can't imagine having to do that many.
Yeah, I had the help of about 3 interns. One was a graphic design artist, the other was an illustrator. And at times the other ones would be writers. But yeah, I was well over my head, but I was working with bigger names and I was made to believe that this is what it was. This is how it goes. This is what it's about, being overwhelmed. This is what comes with it. I was around people that was encouraging dealing with being overwhelmed, dealing with overworking little pay, dealing with not doing self-care, not making sure I get rest, things like that. So I was also smoking weed at this time. So that played a role in the dehydration. So it was just kind of like, I feel like God was just like enough because I was just robotic about it. My family at this point was irritated with me because every time they talked to me, all I did was talk about PR and what I was doing. My whole life was that. I had no life besides that. So anyway, I'm in the hospital and the doctor's telling me between the anxiety from the panic attacks that I was having from trauma and the dehydration, I needed to change what I did for a living or else it would kill me. And I thought that was so dramatic. And I was in the hospital trying to get on my laptop. and update the social media profiles. Yeah, it was, I was obsessive. And she was like, these are your options. Yoga, meditation, Xanax, or music. This is what she told me my options was. Because she was like, what's happening to you is my stomach was starting to, all these things was happening to my body because of the stress. The dehydration, the anxiety, my stomach was creating more acid than usual. Like, it was like, she was telling me my body, the stress was manifesting. And if I did not stop, it would kill me. And she told me to take heed to that and not to underestimate that. She was very serious. Prior to that, I had a colleague tell me, if you don't sit down, God will sit you down. Thanks. And so that happened. And she just told me, pick one. I don't care which one you pick, but you need to do it. I don't want to see you in here again. You're way too young for this. So I picked music. So, like I said, I had music friends. Even though I wasn't on that, I had music friends. I was in studios. I mean, I'm in Atlanta. And from my aunt's relationships, they was around. So I called them up, the different engineers and producers I knew. And I told them what happened. They had knew that I had been in the hospital, but I told them what the doctor told me. Like, I didn't get too deep, but I was just like, the doctor recommended several different options for healing. I'm going to choose music. Can you send me some beats? I'm not even saying I'm going to put them out or none of that. I just want to do it. Like, I was bedridden. I couldn't walk. It was like, I really just had to sit down for about 3 months. I couldn't do anything but be in the house. So I got some composition books. I asked them for beats. They sent it to me. And I cried and wrote in my bed for like 3 months because I couldn't do anything else. And then when I got better and I could, you know, I regained my strength and everything was, and I bounced back. I went back to the same people who sent me the beats and I let them hear it a cappella on paper. Mm-hmm. And they liked them. They was feeling them, but they were like, we want to hear it recorded. To see if it's the same energy, like to see if it's as good as we think.
Yeah, because of all the, you know, there's technicalities, you know, being on the mic and stuff like that, getting everything to translate in the software, you know, is it really as fire as we think it really sounds?
Yeah. Right. And so I was okay with that. Like, that didn't offend me or anything. I understood it. I was like, okay. And so then before I could even think in my mind how I would get that done, they offered to allow me to record it at their studio or pointed me in the direction of a studio. And so I recorded demos and I came back to those people and let them hear it. And their reaction was like, I cried because this was a dream I buried. Remember, singing was my first love. This was, and I always was a writer, but I never, like, I had decided that ship had sailed. It was never gonna happen. So when they hear the demos and they're like, they're blown away. They're like, this is you? We didn't even know you could sing like this. And and they're like, you know, that you could write like this, your wordplay. And why have you been doing PR this whole time? You should have been focused on this. And then it's like, I have people telling me, like, whatever you need, we will help you do this. What do you need? What do you want to do? You want to be a songwriter? It was like this whole shift where nobody wanted to talk to me about PR anymore.
Oh, wow.
Literally. As soon as they heard my music from then on, if I saw them.
It became like that unicorn. It was like, wow.
Yeah. And then it was also weird because of where I was coming from. Yeah. And so they were just kind of like, I think they felt bamboozled.
Like, the whole time we've been focused on doing this, but in all reality, you had this little hidden secret weapon that you just not even like refused to tell anybody about. Like, you particularly, like, you weren't even really thinking about it. Like, that wasn't even a thing in your mind, you know? But to them,
I was oblivious.
Like, yeah, you were oblivious. And then to them, it just ended up being like, God damn. Like,
they thought it was weird. And that's why I said to them, it probably feels like I was a spook that sat by the door because they were just like, why would you not be doing this? And that became the question. And then it got to the point where I was flattered but overwhelmed and shocked that, like, it was confirmation something that I always felt I should be doing and that I could do, but I had settled for doing something else all in the name of, I thought I was being humble and realistic.
Yeah.
To be honest, I thought I made a good decision, a sound one. I thought it was smart, mature. Like that's what I thought in my mind. So anyway, when I got that reaction, and then it was like, I cried making those, you know, I did those to help heal myself in the hospitals. So that's another reason why I was like, you like my pain? Like, you're enjoying this?
Yeah. But that's the thing though. You're not, you know, sometimes we feel like we're the only person going through the things that we go through because it's your reality. And when it's your reality, it's, you know, it's surrounding you 360, 24/7. You know, so you can only think about it being your reality. But in all actuality, you know, you may not be the first or last person to go through those things. So even if it's not an identical situation, there's probably somebody out there that can totally relate. And like, I mean, even as I'm listening to your story, which I think is very beautiful, by the way. I think that this is really going to really, really, really resonate with a lot of people. And I know that you mentioned that they were giving you beats. So like, I'm just really curious, like when these people were giving you these beats, like were they giving them to you pro bono? Like, was there any expectation of some type of compensation down the line? Like, were there terms when they were sending you these beats, or was it like they were just sending them to your email and just saying, do it? Like, how did that go about?
They were sending it to my email. They was just sending me MP3s, or I was just leaving places with beats on a flash drive or a hard drive. And it wasn't any expectation. It wasn't any conversation about money at all.
Yeah.
Because again, I remember the motive. But then even after they heard it, it was like, so what do you want to do? But I do think that they really respected that, you know, there was no faking the funk. So no one could question if I meant it when I was like, you know, shocked that people even liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was writing it, I was just letting them hear it like, look what I did. You know, like kind of cynical about it. I wasn't presenting it like, oh, I just did some fire. It was just like, this is what I did to what you sent me, what you think. Being in Atlanta, and these are people that have done, they do music for a living. One of the first people I presented this to was in a $1 million studio. I mean, so, and he's an engineer that's worked with Future and all types of people. So it's not like I was talking to people who didn't have nothing going on musically and were all up and coming, but they were like super just like, they had told me basically, whatever you're doing, keep doing it and don't let anybody tell you how to do it.
Yeah.
Because how you do it works. So they kind of like, I don't know. It was like, when they sent it to me, they were MP3s to be specific for the file format. So they sent me MP3s. I had already established my reputation as a trustworthy person via PR. I had already had artists that were my friends sending me music raw and uncut from the studio, and I would never release it or send it to anyone. Mm-hmm. They would send it to me for feedback and things like that. You know, I was running people's social media accounts, and some of my friends would give me their phones sometimes to help them pipe up their account. I mean, I had access to credit card information, sensitive information, you know, things like that. So it's kind of like, the trust that they had with me, I don't want to speak for them and say they didn't have any expectations, but I think they trusted that whatever I decided to do, I would let them know before I did it.
Right.
And I think that's why they sent it to me freely and didn't put any pressure on me monetarily, because they knew I was transparent enough to tell them if I wanted to do something and how much I could afford to do if it came time for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to say that's the reason why, but at that time, it was for me to listen to and for me to accept that.
So let's say you did want to go public with it. Like, do you think that they would have been giving you like an exclusive deal when it came to these tracks? Like, and you could toot your horn a little bit if you want. You know what I mean? Like, if you had the juice like that, like, you know what I mean? Like, do you think that they would have done that, or would it have been like a leasing thing? Because I'm gonna be honest with you, like I get a lot of questions about Beats and like, you know, the whole leasing and versus exclusive thing. So like that's just why I'm curious to see how these things work out for you.
No, it's a good question. I get it. I will be real with you. It's levels to it. So it's definitely like okay, so if I would have got an exclusive offer, I would say this. Some of the producers, I made it easy for them. And I would be like, give me your old beats. It doesn't have to be your newest stuff. Just give me something. And I would, and they would like what I did to their old stuff. And they're like, oh my God, you made me love this beat again. You made it so new. Here's some new stuff.
Yeah.
Right. So because of that.
The stuff, the part that you were trying to avoid. Like.
Right. So because of that, they probably would have gave it. I'll say this. Here's the currency I believe that I had that they were aware of. I'm coming from PR with all this access and context. I mean, up to the mayor's ball several times. So with that, it's kind of like, who doesn't want to do a record with somebody that also is going to know how to promote the record.
Facts.
And get it exposure smart. And attention and know what blogs to place. I mean, from Ball Alert to Shaver, all that. So with that, it's like, maybe, they probably, but with that premise though, with the premise that, okay, if I give you this exclusively, you're going to take care of them placements in the media. You're going to take care of those media and blog placements for me. We put this record out. You're going to be able to work the record. Now, as far as the leasing goes, I would say for someone like I had an opportunity to work with Cole's producer, who did the No Role Models record. His name is Phonics Beats. That definitely wouldn't have been exclusive bio. It definitely would have been a lease that probably would have had temporary terms until an exclusive offer did come. And then that might have been the end of that, only because, yes, I'm coming from the PR side and I had that success there locally here in Atlanta and I was understood. And they respected my mind and what I studied and learned outside of that. However, hits still trump a lot of things in music. And on the talent side, I was still like new.
Yeah.
And they were not synonymous to them. So it was kind of like, I couldn't use the PR as leverage, but so much. I knew now the music business side of it, people freely shared that with me because of what I already knew with PR and because of the own research I was already doing on music business stuff. So they were just like, this is a PR mind that I'm talking to about the music business, as opposed to this is an artist that I'm giving all this free game to. That's not how they was looking at it. But in regards to Beats, exclusive, this is my opinion, because I do want to say this because I think this is the answer that artists really want. And I like to simplify things that are typically complex. I feel like
I was on the verge of asking you the question, but I think you already about the answer. So let's go.
Right. Because let's cut all the fat off. Let's get to the point.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So, no, you can ask me. I'm.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously,
but you can ask
there's two routes that you can go. You know, you got a lot of artists using all these platforms, you know, where they're getting their beats, you know, some that make sense, some that don't make sense. And I say don't make sense because, like, you got some people that are just, like, literally ripping beats off YouTube, and that's definitely not the way to go. But, of course, there's a whole thing about leasing a beat versus exclusive, because on any site that you go, you know, like BeatStars or anything that's similar to that, you know, they're always offering, hey, there's a lease option and there's an exclusive option. And, you know, there's a lot of people that I work with and they're just like, I don't know what to do. Like, leasing sounds good because it's cheap. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Exclusive's mad expensive. I ain't got that kind of money. You know, like, it makes it hard for them to make that decision. So, like, just, I do want to know, like, what is your spin on that, you know?
Okay, cool. So, I'm going to give the simple answer, then an example. I'm the queen of examples. So when it comes to lease or exclusive, lease is, you know, it's literal to a lease. Like you lease a car, facts. Like you lease a place. Facts. Exclusive is literal to you buy a house, you buy a car, pay for it cash. So that's that. But now here's an example. because this is intellectual property. So I love to use real estate as an example for IP because it's synonymous. It is still property. It's just a property of our mind, of our creativity.
That's
so
a good way to explain it.
I think so. You know, it helps me get it. I think it's a simple way as opposed to all the jargon and fancy terms. Yeah. You could just forget all that. Yeah. So, okay, with an apartment. You lease an apartment. You know the restrictions. You cannot change the color of the paint of the walls. If you hang stuff up, put nails and screws in the walls, you're going to have to pay for that when you leave because technically it's damaging the walls. You cannot pull the carpet up and lay down your own carpet. Mm-hmm. You probably can't smoke in the unit. Mm-hmm. You may or may not be able to have pets in the unit. You may or may not be able to have guest parking, or they may need a parking pass. Now, you buy a house. You want to paint the walls, you paint the walls. You want to pull up the carpet, you pull up the carpet. You want to replace the sink, you replace the sink. You want to blast your music at 5 in the morning, you blast your music at 5 in the morning. You want to smoke in there, you smoke in there. So, right. So, it's leverages with the freedom. So, now with an apartment, you are aware that that lease going in. You know that. It don't matter how much you spent. They got leases for $10,000 a month, $20,000 a month, $500 a month. The price doesn't matter on the lease. Either way, you know it will end. And when it ends, if you do not renew, you got to go.
Word.
Don't matter how much you love it. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't matter how much you love it. It don't matter how many memories you made in there. It doesn't matter how many people know you live there. It don't matter how many people used to visit you there.
Memories.
I just say it. For real, it's not personal. Like, you don't never be talking to the apartment complex or the owner about how it was living there when it's time to go. You know, you either renew and pay that first month's rent and sign a new lease to lock it in, or you go. So, now let's tie it in. So, now with a lease for a beat, it's going in. You know that. It doesn't matter. Like what you did during the lease, it has its terms, but you can't be like, man, my fans love it. So
nah,
it's going to end. You can't be like 500,000 streams. It's going to end. It's inevitable. It's going to end. So now the levels to the streams. Okay. So normally the cheapest lease, the lowest level lease, not meaning it's a bad lease, but like the first option typically is talking about everything you could do with the MP3 file. So now the file types matter because it has a lot to do with the level. So you have MP3, you have a wave, and then you have stems. MP3 is the most compressed file.
Right.
So when you just think about what compressed means, I look at it as, you know, a file that's kind of smushed. Things are more pressed down together, which ultimately compromises the quality a bit because the sound or the audio doesn't have the room to breathe as much because it's compressed down.
Gotcha.
A WAV file is not compressed the way an MP3 file is. The audio and the frequencies are able to breathe more freely and more fluid in a way because it doesn't have this compression that an MP3 file does. The stems is pretty much like, I call them the bells and whistles of the beat or the knobs. Like if you had knobs to turn things up and down or buttons to press, the stems is like being able to touch the sound exactly, being able to touch the frequencies exactly and do what you will with them. So now MP3, when you're starting off with a lease, like, okay, like on BeatStars, for example, they have a lot of MP3 leases that start at $20, $19.99. You're like, oh, this is what I'm talking
right.
about.
You look like a bargain, right?
Right. You're like, $20? That's just how a beat need to be. However, you're getting an MP3 file. So now this is the understanding that I got because I talked to a good friend. He was an engineer of mine and a songwriter, and he helped explain to me the understanding of files and leases when I got started. So, you know, I like to pay it forward and I like to give props to who planted in me as I planted to another because I don't want to ever come off like, this is all me, I'm so brilliant. Like, no, again, this came from the people along my journey. And I hope people really notice that part where this is a collection a lot of my knowledge is outside of my research on my own. It's a collection of gems from people who I talk to and maybe ask one question or 10, whatever. So MP3 file, that's not a bad thing, first off. It's not bad to get an MP3 file and get it leased. However, it does mean that I don't want to say you're stuck with that file, but you're married to that file as is. Ain't no customization going on. Ain't no tailoring that file. Ain't no editing that file. Why does that matter? So boom, I get an MP3 lease. I love the MP3. I go to the studio, I record. And the engineer, as they begin to mix and master, all they're going to be able to do is mix and master my vocals. Because ain't no stems or no waves. So they can't do nothing with that MP3. So what does that mean? Unless that MP3 was perfectly mixed and mastered down, it may be frequencies that clash. Let's say the drums is a little too high and it's clashing with the melody that you're doing with your voice. Well, if the stems was available, or maybe, well, really it's the stems, they would be able to, the stems allow them to touch one sound at a time instead of all of them.
I get what you're saying. Because once so you compress it, everything is locked in. So, like,
exactly,
the fact that you have, like, a WAV file, you get free roam. Like, you can not only...
It's a little freer, but it's still one file. But it's still just one file. The stems is multiple files. The stems come in the session files.
Yeah, okay, I get it. I come from a technical background, so like when it comes to the software and understanding the files, I get it.
100%. Right? Yeah. So now with the stems, I could have went to the drums folder and just touched the drums and turned them down, whereas if I'm dealing with the wave, I got to now try to get the levels right for the whole thing. Now you could imagine as a sound engineer, this is frustrating to work on because I really can't do nothing. I'm restricted. Right. So how good is the mixing master about to be? Like, how specific can you get? You can't tell me stuff like, okay, so I want the strings at a 6.7 decimal. I want the drums down here at this point. I want reverb on the flute. The engineer gonna be like, you need the stems.
Yeah.
I can't. Word. It's literally not even about being difficult or anything. It can't be done.
Or an act that creates a whole disconnect. Like right there.
Right. And quality could be compromised immediately. Yeah. Right. So with an MP3 file, the thing is, you want to play it across every device and make sure it consistently sounds like what you think and you love that. And so that when you do it, you know that what's getting mixed and mastered is your vocals. That's what you can be specific with and get saucy with and customize. But that MP3 is what it is. I recommend an MP3 lease for freestyles. That's my opinion, because with the freestyle
stuff
situation,
that you don't really care, like not that you don't care about, but like it's
improv. You're improvising when you're making it.
Yeah,
and it's not meant to be polished.
Yeah,
it's meant to just be raw. I did it on a whim here. It's not meant to be like for radio or something.
Word.
MP3s are great for that because then you can get them for $20 and you can feed your fans and give them something, little appetizers, little snacks and dinner rolls in the meantime, as you get in the entree ready. That's my recommendation. And they are cheap to afford. However, I recommend before you get any MP3, play it on your car stereo, play it on your phone, play it in headphones, play it off a tablet,
play it off of this.
Right, because
common channels that people may potentially be listening
exactly,
to the music. To
exactly.
See like,
and make sure it's consistent and make sure you are okay with what you hear consistently. If you are, move forward. However, no, not only is the file restricted, so is the usage of it. Right? So with an MP3 file, you're very limited with what you could do usually. They may say, you can only do 50,000 streams and you can only do free performances and you can only do a one interview via YouTube. You can't put this on radio. You can't do this on a podcast. Those may be some of the terms with the MP3 lease. Just know when you're getting an MP3 lease, in a nutshell, you are just trying to do the bare minimum for something temporary. And you can have a goal to eventually do an exclusive buyout, but typically, if you're going to get an MP3, it's just a quick little, I'm just trying to give something for a moment. However, this may not be a thing, and if it is, it'll be a shocker for me.
Right. That's very good. That's good information right there, because I feel like there's always some confusion that comes with the whole process, and it's just good to have that clarity, because one thing I'd hate to see, because when you really think about it, and I was literally just having this conversation before we jumped on this podcast, I was talking with a guy about the song Whoopty by CJ, and the song itself is like a year and some change old, but of course it's new to the Billboard and the rest of the world right now. But that song has been pushed for so long, like, and I kind of, if I could say, like, let's say he had a lease on that, you know, given the success that it's at right now, there would be some discussions that would have to be had between he and whoever he got the beat from, you know, given the way that it's going right now. So it's just always interesting to understand the finer details between, you know, leasing versus exclusive, because I know that a lot of people just, they have a hard time figuring it out. So, I mean, I really loved your analogy and the way that you broke it down. Like, I think that makes really, really good sense for people to understand. If you can't understand it beyond that, then I don't really know, but I'm really curious to find out more about, like, you know, just your experiences with engineers too as a songwriter, because I know the engineer is one of those people that they don't really get talked about too much, you know, like the record gets produced and then after that it's kind of like the artist gets all the shine, but the engineer is definitely a huge role in that process. Your engineer would honestly be the one to tell you, bro, you need to go and get, or sis, you need to go and get, you know, that WAV file. You need to go get the MP3 file if you're trying to get it to sound like what we may or may not be arguing about in this studio right now. So, like, how important is that role, you know, or that relationship with the engineer? Like, tell me about that, or your experiences with that.
It's funny you asked me that. I was just talking to my engineer, my favorite one, before we got on this call. So, first of all, it's a shame how engineers are treated. I love them because they...
Me too.
They really make it happen. They deal with so much, man, and they make it happen. They make it happen. So I think, first off, for me, my relationship with engineers has always been, it's always been like a very direct one, but also a very nurturing one. And what I mean by that is, on the direct side, I'm the artist. I will send you an email with bullet points on my mix and my master. I'm just a thorough analytical mind. So I'm very detail oriented. My ear hears everything and it all matters and I want it all right. It ain't no, oh, don't worry about that. I'm worried about it and I want it right. And because I'm like that, I try to balance it out with being nurturing. Like when I come to the studio, hey, did you eat? Do you need anything? I can get you something. What do you want? You know, like just trying to balance out and make it worth their while outside of paying them. So like for me, my relationship with engineers is a lot of them have become my friends. The ones that I work with, we're pretty cool. Like I like to include them on credit for the record if I can. And I try to empower them. A lot of them produce as well and make beats. I try to play their beats for others when I can to shop them. They're a lot of times the only person in the studio with me. So it's normally me and an engineer for 4 or 6 hours, just rocking out. A lot of times I let them vocal produce me as well, because when I'm in a booth, I do not want you sitting there letting me do whatever I think is great. If it's not working, tell me that. If I need to switch it up, tell me that. If I'm off key, tell me that. If I'm flat, tell me that. If that bar was whack, tell me that. Respectfully, but tell me that. So I think I've been able to cultivate healthy relationships with engineers because I give them I think, more creative control than most, but I also am honest with them about my boundaries, that I don't want them to step into my creative control either. I think I think I'm good with coexisting with them without making them feel less than or inferior. I value them and I value their opinions, and I think they play a bigger role than most.
They do. I mean, and they come with that expertise. First of all, they come with the expertise of the digital audio workstation they're using, whether it be Pro Tools, Logic, Ableton, Cubase, whatever. You know what I mean? They come with that background. So, like, that alone, you know what I'm saying? If you don't already know about that stuff on your own, that alone should make you have love for them. You know what
Period.
I mean?
Period. Like,
it should make you have an extreme respect for what they do. So if your engineer is saying, you know, maybe you should try this and try that, you know, be open to it. Not saying that you give up your complete creative freedom, but be open to it and apply it accordingly where you see fit, you know? So I think that's a very important thing. Like having good chemistry
is an
important thing with your engineer. Like you must have good chemistry, because if you don't, then that's going to result in a poor product.
It's so important.
Product, what are you gonna do with it?
It's so important, and I'm also very submissive to them because I care about their opinion the most, because I know their ears are very sensitive, because they listen to audio all day. So if you think you hear good, their listening is heightened. So for me, it's trained, it's skilled, it's heightened, it's sharper than the average person. So it's like, if it's any opinion I want, it's the engineer. Mm-hmm. And that's honestly before anybody, because very rarely are they off. A lot of times they're spot on, but a lot of times they're super respectful of the fact that, you know, they're used to people being like, shut up and record type of energy with them.
Oh, God.
Which is terrible, but they used to that. So a lot of them won't say nothing. The professional skill ones will just let you sound a mess if that's what you want to do. But when you allow them to be inclusive, oh my God, they're going to make sure it's right. And for me, I'm not missing out on that because of no stupid ego. No, thank you.
Right. Because you never know what type of fire that, you know, they might hear. Like, they might hear something that's light years ahead of what you hear. They know, they can tell if you're capable of it or not just from that experience that they're going through with you. So to choose not to listen to the engineer is kind of like...
kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. Like, the engineer is obviously an engineer, you know, at whatever studio at for a reason. So, you know, and I have to say that there's no engineers out there that is just like completely be out of pocket. You know what I mean? Right, I'm pretty sure it's some, you know, that's with any industry. That's with any profession. With
period.
Any, like, there's going to always be that one or two people that's just completely out of pocket, and you just got to set them straight. But other than that, like, you know, for the most part, I feel like an engineer is there to help. And if they do give you a suggestion, they're not completely, I guess for lack of better terms, like, they're just not completely wore out from dealing with other artists to tell them to shut up and record. If they do open their mouth and say, try this, then you should be open to doing it. So outside of, like, you know, like your experiences with that, because I'm pretty sure you got stories for days for that, even down to, like, you know, just like the leasing and the whole beat situation, and even down to how you even came about to being a songwriter, there's always been challenges. So I want to know, like, overall, what is some of the biggest challenges that you see that, you know, artists struggle with? And even if you want to just speak about yourself, like, what's the biggest thing that you struggle with throughout, you know, the entire journey of being a songwriter or leading up to a songwriter? And if you have any advice for artists, like, what would you give them?
Oh, that's a good question. You ask really good questions.
Hey, like, I try.
Okay. My biggest struggle was, my biggest struggle specifically as a songwriter, because I didn't even, now I've decided to be an artist for various reasons, but it was all about being a songwriter. My biggest struggle at that time was, it was trust. And that sounds broad and cliche, but it really was like, I was paranoid to some degree because of the way that people would, like, you know, it was like this vulture energy when they would, I struggled with trust when it came to wanting leadership and guidance through that industry, mm-hmm. but then being afraid and kind of knowing it was inevitable that I would be stolen from in the process of being led.
Okay, yeah. That's what you mean by, like, the whole, just the vulture culture.
Yeah, it was really unfortunate. And that's, I mean, my first songwriting deal, it wasn't even a deal. It was a trial period for a deal for a year. And I'm thinking I signed a contract and it was a promissory note about a bunch of money I would give them if the records went gold, platinum, or double platinum. And in this agreement or contract, which I have receipts for all of this anyway, I just, you know, let people live. And I haven't went on smear campaigns, but it didn't say they would protect me from anything. It's talked about everything I would give them. And so they also, you know, at that time, I wasn't even with ASCAP or BMI. And when I asked about a pro, that's what ruined the relationship. Like, literally. Really? Yes. When I asked about, should I be with ASCAP or BMI? Because I wasn't with the pro, but I write in the composition notebooks. I already had all this stuff written on paper from my pen and my composition notebooks. And I went to the studio and started recording demos. And I was trying to show them, I can keep this going. I can do a bunch of songs. I was so busy trying to prove myself that I didn't realize that I was doing things without it being registered. And so it was two power moves that happened. I set up the session at the studio to record these demos. One of the person that was considering me for this deal came and showed up and paid for the session. Huge power move. Didn't understand it at the time, but that was to have access to the masters. That was to have rights to them. Whoever paid for the session has the rights to them. I didn't know that. They didn't tell me that. They just came up there. And I was like, wow, that was nice. They just paid for the session. Like, clearly naive, right. But that was a power move on there, and for access or rights to the masters. These are the subtle things that happen where people won't say, and you'll be just lost. And then when I went to Michael Made It's Ransom 2 party at Red Martini, and this was during that time, so I was up there, and people in the room, it was a bunch of people in the room. Everybody was somebody or whatever. It was that type of event. So people were asking me, like, you know, hey, what pro are you with? Who do you have distribution with? And I could not answer the question because I wasn't with nobody. And I didn't even know a name to just wing it. And so there I am looking stupid, not knowing.
Wow.
And so when I went back, I talked to the person after the fact, and it was like, how did everything go? If you have any questions, let me know. I was like, I'm glad you said that. I'm like, what is a pro? And, like, do we have distribution? And, like, you know, I'm just asking because I think I look really silly tonight, and I couldn't answer this when somebody asked me. And we was talking about record, you know, going to the studio together, and I think it will probably never happen because I couldn't even answer this. And I was like, so, and next time I just want to be more prepared. I don't want to look so silly. So shouldn't I, what's a pro and who should I be with them? A distribution went off, flipped on me and told me I should be worried about making these songs like how they make songs. And this is the person who has hit records, did records with Keisha Cole, different people, et cetera. And that was the answer, that I should be trying to write songs like them. And be trying to learn from their example creatively as opposed to worrying about that. I'm not even on that level yet to be concerned with that.
Nah.
They told me I had 24 hours to get back to them and say what needed to be said so they could know I was going to move forward. So me that being me, scary. I call back.
That gives me so Man, many, listen. Like, unpositive feelings. You know, like, I don't like that.
Listen, I called them back a minute before. It would have been 24 hours. That's just me being petty. And literally, that was 11 o'clock at night when that happened. I called them back at 10:59 on purpose. the next night, and they asked me, "You ready now?" And I was like, "Ready for what?" And they were like, "You know what you, don't you have something to say to me?" I'm like, "I don't know what you're looking for me to say. We just got on the phone. Like, how about hi?"
Word.
So obviously, that didn't go any further. But I had already understood that I had to, see, for me, anytime I noticed something shady happened, I would just kind of reroute and keep it moving. I wouldn't let them know that I was aware. I would just get up out of there. Yeah. I wouldn't have no conversation like, "You're exposed." No, I'm not doing all that. I would just let my actions show you, "Oh, I see what's going on. I'm out of here." So basically the goal was for me to do the songs and for them to be registered and ASCAP under their name.
And to eat off you.
And I would have never, I wouldn't have existed.
Right.
And they would have no record of it. So anyway, that's just an example of the struggle with trust. And then my second biggest struggle, it's not a struggle anymore. It's a beauty to it now. But I used to think it was a struggle to not like to create when I wasn't feeling it.
That's good.
Yeah, I got a lot of, crap for that. But it was that, remember I told you, I started doing it when I was sick and I cried through it and all this stuff. So it was very emotional when I did it. That's why I started doing it. Yeah. For therapy. That's
kind of what led you to feeling like it only makes sense to do it if I feel like something is worth doing it.
Yeah, so it was kind of like when I seen this culture of everybody wants to do it for money and prove that they can do it and do it well for money, I immediately felt outcasted because I'm like, wow, I guess I'm weird. I'm just trying to feel some type of way and then do it. Like, I used to literally wait till I felt some type of way. It annoys me negative, good or bad. Like, if I just went shopping and got and felt really fly, I'm about to make a record about going shopping and getting fly.
Yeah.
Because I'm feeling that today. If I just got my hair done and I got a new hair color, I'm about to make a record about fresh nails, fresh hair, I'm feeling. If I got my heart broken, I'm about to make a record about, "I can't believe he did this to me." Yeah, it was like I was intentionally going off of what, when my stimuli, I was led by my stimuli and I would intentionally and strategically create when I was intensely feeling any emotion because I knew that was my best work. Like every time I played stuff that I made when I wasn't feeling it, wasn't nobody crazy about it. They were like, "Oh, that song was cool." But when I played the record and I was on my feelings, probably crying, bottle of wine, or probably just like, just really like I was in my feelings, or if I was really, really happy and euphoric, whatever, they would, and I knew that it was better that way because they would tell me, "I can feel it. Wow, I feel your energy on this record. This record feels good. Wow, I can tell you were really hurt. I felt that. I'm going through that." And I was like, "Oh, so this feeling thing is like a part of the sauce. This is my special ingredient. I got to keep this." So then I stopped looking at it as a struggle and I started embracing, like, that's just how I create. That's what it is. That's what makes me tick. That's a part of my sauce. And if I'm going to do my best work, I got to feel it. So I'm going to just be ferocious about that. I'm not going to let nobody force me to create when I don't feel it. But for a long time, people always tried to make me feel insecure about that or make me feel like if you was really on your grind and really dope and talented, you could just make a song. You don't have to feel it. At the drop of a dime, you just make a song. And it's like, I can make a song at the drop of a dime. It's not that I can't. It's about how great it will be.
Right.
And I just don't have an interest in making a bunch of mediocre songs just to show that I can make songs whenever. I'm trying to make a great song every time I make it. And I need to be in my feelings. So those my two. As far as with artists, I think you asked me what struggle do I see them dealing with?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even if it's just your personal ones, like, that's fine, too. And I mean, I think you really you nailed that question, too, without even realizing you nailed it. Like, you already gave them the advice, because I'm pretty sure there's other people that feel the exact same way. Like, even me, like, every now and then, like, I still like to rap. So one thing just like you, if it's like, I need a pivotal moment before I could do this. No, but that's not necessarily the case. Like, you probably already had 5 pivotal moments today. You just didn't see them. You know what I'm saying? So like when you start to look at it through that lens of things, you begin to realize that like there's inspiration and there's creativity all around you. You just have to be able to find it. And then once you find it and harness it, you know, you can really narrow it down. Like, you know, once you get behind that mic. So man, I think you did a really great job at answering that question. Now, what I'm wondering is, and it's funny because on your Clubhouse, your bio, it says you're offering free game until your EP drops or your album drops. And I think that's pretty funny. Do you plan on offering any services? Cause you got so much experience. You have so much to give, you know, so much to offer. And I feel like, you know, you would be a really great asset in this similar community that, you know, I am now a part of, I'm blessed to be a part of and help all these artists out with. Like, do you see yourself going that route? Or is it right now you still, you know, feeling like a songwriter? Are you thinking maybe you want to go back to PR? Like, you know, where do you stand right now with everything?
I've definitely been all over the place. But when the dust settles for me, I'm an artist. I'm a writer first, though. It's not just about music, just writing in general. With PR, you got to write as much as you talk. Yeah. So they go hand in hand. So I lead with writer because it's the only thing that makes it so being all over the place is not in vain, because then it just means I can write about a lot. So that's why I embrace that title. Not that they really matter for me, but so this was my goal with Clubhouse. I wanted to lead me to public speaking about the music business. Mm-hmm. But for me, I'm more concerned with, yes, I'm going to do my music regardless. That's what's happening. But as far as to give this back, I want it to be tied into motivational speaking, but, you know, with a little humor. Like, I wanted it to be like...
Yeah, lighthearted.
Lighthearted. Like, I don't want to say a stand-up. I'm not a comedian. But if you could blend a stand-up with...
In some respect.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if you could blend a stand-up with motivational speaking with a music conference, all had a baby. Yeah. That's how I want it to be. Like, I just want to have live Q&As where I want people to be able to sit. I want to be able to do this in a giant room full of artists. And they just throw questions at me. And I just answer them the best that I can. So I said free game to my album drop because I would rather be compensated for what I'm doing via tickets and you come in a room and we have a conversation and you can really pick my brain, yeah, as opposed to a package with a service and all this other stuff. Like, I don't like being involved with the execution of the knowledge. That's what I learned about me. That's why I stopped doing PR. It's none of my business. I don't care about that part. That's up to you. If you apply it, how you apply it, when you apply it, if it went well, I don't want to be involved in that. I would rather just give it to you and then you apply it however you feel or see fit. And then you come back when you need to know some more to apply some more. That's the position I would like to be in. And I don't believe a resume could get me there. I mean, I guess in some degree it has, but I feel like this opportunity to speak with you came from conversing. Thanks. And so that's what attracted me to Clubhouse, where I'm like, finally, we can just go off of what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
because it's going to add up. It'll add up or it won't. You're going to know if I know what I'm talking about and if I don't. You're going to know if it makes sense or if it don't. You could Google stuff while I'm talking. I encourage people to. So for me, outside of doing my music, because that is a form of ministry for me, that's going to bring some healing and understanding because it is emotional. But the other side of it is, yes, I would rather just, I think public speaking is a better fit, even in consulting and all of that, because again, I don't like the idea of taxing you by the minute for a conversation that I know could veer off, because I just know that's how I could go, and there's nothing wrong with that. So I would rather you buy a ticket. It's that one-time fee. It's probably way more affordable than what any package would be or any by the minute, by the hour situation. And you come in a room and everybody is able to at least ask one valuable question and get one valuable answer, or at least ask three valuable questions and get three valuable answers. Right. And then take that gem, a heavy gem, like a ruby or a diamond, a big one. And some of the stuff I'll share with you may take years to apply. It's not stuff that you can just do overnight. You know what I mean? And I mean that modestly. Yeah, that's what was given to me. So I'm going to be honest, Clubhouse is the first manifestation of a path that I thought would go directly to that. So that's why I was spending so much time on there. Like, free game to my album drop, free, because I wanted a slogan. I'm like, what slogan can I come up with? And people will get what I'm saying. That's just to the point, and I do not have to explain it. And nobody's asked me to explain it. I think it's very clear, because when my album drops, I'm going to be in music mode.
Yeah, you're right. In a different bag. And I think that that's very important, because one thing that one of my OGs said to me a while ago, like way before I even started doing this, I had so many things that I was good at the time. Like, I was great at web design. I was good at, you know, engineering music. Like, I was good at, you know, being the artist. Like, I was just good at a lot. And he took me out, like, in the backyard. We were just having a conversation. And he was just like, look, bro, like, I know there's a lot of things that you're good at, but, you know, you don't want to be like a three-headed dragon on one body. Like, you know, you can only focus on one thing at a time. So I think that that's a really dope slogan that you have, which is why it like really resonated with me, because I will never forget this conversation I had with my OG. You know what I'm saying? So it just makes sense. And, you know, you want to offer your best to people. So like, if your best at that time is making sure that you push your project so that you can push your message, you know what I mean, or whatever your agenda is, then that's important. And the outside of that time, if, you know, you're willing to offer your time to help out other people and get them going forward with whatever they want to do, then let your mind be free of all other things and be able to focus and give them attention on that. Because who wants divide? Nobody wants divided attention. Like, divided attention, that just sucks.
You know, yeah, it's like, annoying.
Yeah, and you can kind of tell when someone's giving you divided attention, and like, everything just, it just doesn't form well. You know,
it don't hit the same.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It don't hit the same
at all. Versus when someone can give you that undivided attention to whatever that subject matter is. So that's dope. I really want to know. I really want to know. You know, just taking us out here. What is the impact that you want to leave in the world with the work that you do? This is honestly my favorite question.
You said it like it was your favorite.
It is. It's my favorite question. Okay. Go for it.
Yeah, why is it your favorite? Tell me.
It's my personal favorite because I feel like we all do. We feel like we shouldn't be walking this world without a purpose. I think a lot of us struggle with finding what our purpose is and what work we're here to do. You know, and I hate to run into people who are just living for the sake of living. You know, like, I mean, I don't know. My dad always told me that you can't judge people for what brings them happiness. You know, like, if that's what brings someone's happy, brings a person happiness, then, you know, cool. Like, cool. But me personally, I feel like we should all have a purpose. We should all have a reason for why we do what we do. We shouldn't be doing it for, you know, shits and giggles. You know, you know, so that's why it's definitely one of my favorite questions, because I personally get motivated through hearing other people's passion. Like, is that weird? Like, I don't know. Like, when other people are super passionate about something, like, I don't care what it is.
It's infectious.
About word. We could be talking about welding. You could be talking about how passionate you are about being a freaking welder. Like, I don't care. Like, if you're passionate about that, like, that just makes me feel like, well, I don't necessarily want to be a welder, but just like that passion, like, it's like you said, it's infectious, and that passion is that shit is gold. So yeah, that makes me want to know, like, you know, for you and even all others that I speak to, like, what's your ultimate goal? You're like, you know, what do you want to impact this world with the things that you do? Or how do you want to do that?
That's a good question. Nobody's asked me that. That's cool, though. I definitely think passion is attractive. So I get what she's saying. So first off, my passion, first and foremost, is to be a woman of God, a child of God. Jesus saved my life. Yes, ma'am. And I know he's using me to save the life of others. I'm not religious, so I don't go around trying to shove it down anyone's throat. However, I do have to acknowledge him when it comes to questions of purpose, because that's the only reason why I know mine. So I know first and foremost, my purpose is to be as close to like Christ as I can. And I mean with my actions more so than whatever I say. Word. And so I believe that I had somebody tell me along my PR journey when I was having a moment, I was like, I hate this. How would I quit? This industry so disgusting and despicable. These monsters. I was in that mode. And he told me, how do you know your ministry is not to lead other women, guide them through this murky waters of the industry?
Yeah.
And he just said that to me and dropped the mic on them. It was just like, yeah, hold that. Think about that. And it always stuck with me. And I definitely think he was spot on. This was like 7 years ago. So I say that to say, I believe that the impact I will have on this earth, I hope to have it, is to really be an advocate for creatives and to really be like a Harriet Tubman for them. Oh, in a sense. Fire. And not that I'm like, oh God, not that I'm Harriet, because I'm not saying that, but I do mean like, I do feel like the spook that sat by the door, because I think that God put me in that position in PR at first, to show me that I didn't want what I think I wanted. And then also to show me what I needed to know for me to take care of my business, right? Mm-hmm. And then also show me what I need to show others. So. Yeah. The main impact I hope to have is I hope to be an ally that artists have ran across and they can honestly say years from now, you know, Ina Sabaz, you know, one thing I could say is like, she really helped me and it was no ulterior motive. Like, she just did it and it was genuine. And I really want to prove it's genuine by, if anything else comes from it, then it's a blessing. I'm not out here trying to hide motives and trying to act like I'm just doing everything for free. I don't want anything. And, you know, I'm not saying that. I have my wants like anyone else.
Right.
But I just would like to be a person that has impacted artists in a way where if I did want something, they knew that from the gate. It wasn't a surprise they found out later on. It wasn't these hidden strings attached down the line that I yanked and they didn't know was there. Mm-hmm. I just want to be like, I really want to be an ally for creators, and I really do want to empower them, and I want them to take their power back, and I want them to get to a place where they understand that this industry is on your back. Mm-hmm. It's thriving on your back. It's thriving because of your imagination and your courage and ability to be brave enough, to be crazy enough or delusional enough, yeah, to think that you can turn creativity into reality, that you could take things from your mind and make them real and make them exist. And I really hope that I can empower them so that, you know, certain drug addictions can end. I know a lot of artists, you know, turn to substance abuse to deal with the abuse they deal with in this business. I really believe that. I hope that I can impact and empower some of them to the point where they don't need that anymore. I hope that I can help them be more stubborn about their creative process and not be so quick to let people in and tell them how to be them and how to create. I mean, I'm just about the artist first. So, yeah.
No, that's an excellent, hey, let me tell you, that's a beautiful story. That's an excellent, like, your brand. Like, right there, like, that is your brand, and that is awesome. Like, I think I'm pretty much on the same exact page as you. Like, I understand that, you know, there are a lot of people that are in the business that are out for themselves. And I think that's a shame, especially because, you know, in being that way, you know, they're going to take advantage of a lot of people who have such true intentions. And I'm not here.
You're gonna make me cry.
And I agree with you. I'm like literally like completely in line with you. Like, I feel like I started out, you know, wanting to be a recording artist, and then like I've migrated into so many different other positions. And in each one of those positions, it showed me like I pivoted from each one of those positions with lessons, of course. But the ultimate lesson, you know, the ultimate pivot was coming to be in the position that I'm at right now, which is being an educator. And it's because I learned so much at each one of those points that felt like at the time they were for me. I'm telling you, at every position I played, I've been the videographer, photographer, manager, recording engineer, producer, like beat or beat maker, because, you know, there is a difference between the two. Like, like in every position, I felt like that was supposed to be my calling. Like I felt it strongly at the time.
Yes, but, I know what you mean. You
yeah, too. Like I felt that you couldn't tell me. You could not. We would get in arguments if you told me I wasn't meant
me
to
too.
Be there.
Me too.
Like, me too. You know what I'm saying? Like, forget all that. I'm not trying to hear none of that. But some way, somehow, I still pivoted to other positions. And where I'm at right now has by far been the most fulfilling. And I know it would be crazy of me to sit here and say, I feel the strongest about this position because I felt that way about everything else. But I'm telling you, this time it feels divine. You know, all those other times it didn't feel divine. If it just felt like those were just emotions I was going through. Right now, this particular time that I'm at right now feels like this is where I'm supposed to be in this because that is what I'm supposed to do. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. So that's I completely feel you on that notion. And with that, I just want to wrap things up. I want you to tell people, you know, where they can follow you, you know, how they can get in contact with you if need be. And yeah, because this has been phenomenal. Like, I thank you so much. Like, you have no idea what you've done for me in just speaking to me just now.
Wow. I could say the same. Like I said, this is my first podcast. I've ducked and dodged speaking on my story for so long because for a long time I wasn't proud of it. It was like all over the place and I didn't know what was going on and nothing was making sense. And so it's very, for this to happen at the top of 2021, it's very symbolic for me.
Word.
It's a lot of confirmation. Yeah, it's the first time I got to merge both worlds. It's the first time I've been able to define where I'm coming, where I came from and where I'm at in the music business. And that was hard trying to get it all together, but I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate the chance to talk to you. Wait, I wanted to ask you this though, if I can.
Before
you go, what made you start Let's Talk About Music? Because I love that name and I like talking to you about music, but I wonder how was it birthed?
I don't know. Like it just made sense when I thought about it. Honestly, if you would have asked me a year ago if I was gonna start a podcast, I would have been like, fuck no. but like because on my platform, I feel like with my brand, I do need to be a little, not careful. I feel like careful is not the right word, but I do need to be very well calculated with the way that I do stuff like on Instagram and just social media in general. But I wanted a place where like I could just really talk, like, you know what I'm saying? Like talk about what's on my mind and speak what's on my heart. And when the podcast idea came around, it was like, all right, this is my podcast. Like this is totally, this is off Instagram, you know what I mean? It's off Facebook, this is off all of that. Like, this is my space. I feel like this is my sacred space to talk about the topic that I'm very passionate about. So, you know, it's literally just Let's Talk Music. You know, and that's what we're doing. Like, I was trying to think about calling it something like super catchy and all that other stuff, but like, man, forget all of that. I feel like when you start thinking about that, you'd be overanalyzing stuff. And like I'm trying to do a better job at not overanalyzing stuff and just go with my feeling. And my feeling was like, let's just call it Let's Talk Music. And that's what we do. We come out here, we talk music. Simple.
Where dope.
I try to premeditate it. Sometimes things veer off the left field, but it's never left field. It's always information that people want to know. And when I feature people on it, I only bring people on it that I feel like are gonna be a huge asset. Like I've already I vetted you, like I've studied you, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't just bring you on here because, like, I just heard you for a couple seconds and was like, all right, I got to bring this person on there. Because, you know, some people be out here being imposters, man. You know? So, and, like, I don't want that. Like, I genuinely want to help people. And I want to make sure that they get the best advice. When my name is attached to anything, I want people to know. You know what I mean? Like you said, during this interview, you said, you know, one of your biggest problems was just trusting people in a business that's very cutthroat. Like, I don't want you to feel like that when you come across my name. And like, when you see my name, I want you to be like that dude right there. He's valid. You know what I'm saying?
Well, facts. Well, look, you achieved that. I've been felt like that before the podcast. I think you're such an eloquent speaker.
Thank you.
I love your energy. It's something very warm, but stern, but yeah, it's comforting, but it's not comforting. Like, well, it's not
creepy.
It's a firmness there. It's firm though. It's definitely like, no nonsense, but not in the sense of like over the top, like an like you're like tripping about it, but I can feel the firmness there. But I think that you're also very thorough and detail oriented, which I appreciate. But I just appreciate this as a whole. I'm Ina Savaz. You can definitely follow me at Ina Savaz Everything, INASAVAZ. That's my Instagram. That's my Facebook. That's my streaming. That's my website. I try to keep everything online simple and the same. It's all Ina Savaz. It's free game to my album drop. I don't have a release date for my album yet, but I will be keeping people posted. Right now, I'm the most active on Clubhouse. If you're on there, we can chat. Keys, you know that. Outside of just what we did, I'll definitely be keeping up with what you guys got going on, and I definitely will be consistently sharing it with my people. I appreciate this so much. Thank you for having me. To all the artists that may be listening, or even if you're not an artist and you know one or you work with them, I have a lot of love for you. I hope you consider me an ally. Please reach out to me if you would like to. Let's get connected, and thank you so much, Keys, for letting us talk music. This was so fun.
No doubt. Look at that. Get that free game for that album drop. Because after that, I don't know about it. I can't help you.
Right, that part.
I can't help you.